This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton. John is the president of Etherton & Associates, a firm that focuses on activities on Capitol Hill and what's going on there. And John has an illustrious career in procurement, working on the Hill for over 18 years, Senate Armed Services Committee for a large part of that, is acknowledged as one of the leading, well, put it this way, a thought leader in government procurement and what's going on by very evidence that he was on the SARA panel and helped put together that report. And also, he's a great friend of the show. John, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Roger. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, John, we want to turn immediately to the business at hand and what's going on Capitol Hill. And can you start to talk a little bit about, you know, the mystery that is the budget process and what's going on there?
Well, we have the budget, obviously, and the part of it that I'm focusing primarily on is the Defense Department portion, but there are other agency budgets that are also of interest. A lot of preparation this year before the budget came over from the Department of Defense and explaining the strategy and the direction that they wanted to go and really sort of laying the groundwork for the actual numbers. And even since the budget has come out, we've gotten a number of folks at fairly high levels that have come out and explained their various portions of it. But I think what we're looking at this year is obviously an election year. I think the expectations for what happens before the election are not real high. The committees, if you go look at their hearing schedules, and if you review especially the Senate Armed Services Committee and the Appropriations Committees, they're already starting to move out with their schedule. Most of the hearings into early March are already scheduled. The indication is that they want to start examining the issues. They want to get into the issues in depth. There's been some suggestion that on the House side, they may try to accelerate the process and actually move the markups of the authorization and appropriation bills up a little bit from their normal times, starting in late April, early May, and have the bills ready and on and off the floor on the appropriation side more or less complete before the August recess, because there'll be a longer recess this year because of the conventions. That remains to be seen whether that will happen or not. But I don't think that anyone has any illusion that the budgets will be done and that we will be operating on anything other than a continuing resolution for all of the federal agencies come 1st of October. And I think most people believe that the real action that will occur will happen after the election in what is going to be the inevitable lame duck session this year. We not only have the FY13 budget basics to work out in the numbers, it's helped a little bit this year because we do have the budget agreement that was worked out last year on the FY13 overall top line. But obviously one of the main issues that has to be addressed is sequestration and what impact that may have on the Department of Defense and on the civilian agencies. And again, a lot of people are suggesting on the Hill that sequestration will not occur no matter what, and I have yet to hear one person explain a plausible scenario of how we make it go away. So I think that a lot of that will also be concentrated discussion and different proposals that will come up after the election and when the lame duck session occurs. And it certainly is not clear to me, at least from what I'm seeing and the rhetoric I'm hearing, that we'll actually have a solution to the sequestration issue before it will actually go into effect in early January.
So could you just, for the folks, lay out, you know, how sequestration would work and what it means for the in particular for the defense budget? I think that's everybody's sort of focus. At least when you hear quote the rhetoric, you hear folks talking about trying to, you know, overturn the whole idea, the whole concept, or saving particular programs within the defense budget. So,
well, just to go over to there have been a lot of discussions about the mechanics of it, but the folks who were around in the 1980s and early 90s will remember the Graham Rudman Hollings process.
I'm old enough to remember that.
You remember that.
I think I learned about it, though. No, I'm just kidding.
Studied it in
you
school.
You lived it, right?
Yeah, right. You did it in one of your elementary school papers, right? The thing is that for the way that process works is essentially what is mandated in the Budget Control Act for sequestration next year. And there's some things about it, I think, that are not generally understood. The way it would work for the Department of Defense is that essentially you would look at all of the appropriations accounts, and there are roughly 80-some different accounts in the appropriations bill. If you want to figure out what they are, all you have to do is go through the last year's appropriations bill and look at the separate accounts. And there are things like personnel Army, personnel Air Force, personnel Reserve, personnel Marine Corps, RDT&E, Air Force, Army, et cetera. And based on the way it would work is you would basically have to take a certain percentage on each one of those accounts across the board in order to reach the target number that you would need to reach in order to hit the total. And it's about $50 billion that would be required in FY13. Now, so this basically puts a couple of problems out there. Number one, if, say, someone says, well, we'll buy our way out of sequestration by canceling this program, that doesn't really work under the way the rules work. You could essentially do an across-the-board cut and then reorder that through a reprogramming, which would be a very cumbersome process. But it really doesn't leave a lot of flexibility for the department. The one area that the president does have some flexibility in the Budget Control Act is with respect to the military personnel accounts. And in the Budget Control Act, the president has the authority to exempt the military personnel accounts from the cuts. So the basic calculation is that if the president does not exempt the military personnel accounts, that you're looking at probably around a 10% across-the-board cut in each of the accounts, including military personnel. If the president, however, exempts the military personnel, as I believe he probably would do, then that would raise the percentage for the remaining accounts to about 13%. So it would be a pretty significant cut across the board, and it would really does not really give the department a lot of flexibility in how they manage. However, once they take those percentage cuts in each of the accounts, within the accounts, they do have some flexibility as to how to actually allocate those cuts. But it's a very, very difficult tool to manage under if you're trying to pull together a coherent military posture that supports a national strategy.
Right, Well, the idea of cutting a particular program doesn't, I mean, there's costs associated with canceling a program, right? It's not a zero-sum game in the sense of, oh, I cut this program, that means I got $50 billion. It's like there's costs associated with closing it down that have to be incurred as well.
Right, you have termination liability costs associated with that. And if you stretch programs, as we're already seeing with some of the decisions in the FY13 budget that we have, then the unit costs go up for all the systems in that program.
Right, And I guess, you know, your point about trying to create a coherent sort of defense posture when you're having to do, let's say, arbitrarily 10% cuts across all these accounts, that doesn't mean you're not making business decisions or defense decisions based on what the need really is or where we need to focus, given the resources we're dedicating to it. It's more about, you're just a flat line number, let's take 10% off the top, then figure it out, the rest of it, which puts even more pressure on the decision makers.
Right, and then you're faced with a situation of then what do you do, which is then you essentially have to reassemble what you can with what you've got left, maybe make some reprogramming decisions, and then deal with the baseline and the FY14 requests and absorb some of the impacts that you're doing with sequestration in FY13. So it's a very, very difficult management problem, and it just compounds itself in the out years.
Now, part of that management problem, and I don't know if you're looking at this or not, John, but you know, at the same time, you know, this, you know, I guess the, is it Democly sort of sequestration, you know, to be cliche, the department is facing potentially, and just figuring out how to manage to, you know, reduce resources. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of public discussion of reorientating our strategy towards the Pacific. You know, we're coming home from, come home primarily from Iraq, and we're working towards that in Afghanistan. And, you know, it seems to me it's a further dynamic that folks have to think about.
Exactly. And I think one of the other things that we'll also be facing, I believe, as we get into the latter part of this year, is that with no real clear solution out there for avoiding sequestration, the agencies and the Department of Defense and other agencies and departments are going to have to start making decisions anticipating what the impacts of sequestration might be, and decisions which will be designed to mitigate the impacts. People have to treat it like it's a real thing. And so you'll already start to see the effects of it working backwards into this year, I think, at some point.
So you might see it, you know, slowing momentum of purchases and things like that? Is that what you're saying?
Especially things where people have a lot of control. I think that's one of the expectations that I have.
And how does, you know, just sort of looking in how much talk, because you hear about it a little bit in the news, is, you know, in terms of when they're looking at how to, you know, reduce costs or be more efficient, you know, and maybe it's a third rail, but the idea of, you know, the veterans, or not necessarily veterans, but, you know, benefits for, you know, the troops and, you know, medical benefits and TRICARE and all those things. Is that something they're looking at on the Hill or not?
It's something that I think people are hearing the department talk about, whether in fact there's enough support to actually seriously go into some of those areas. It's not clear to me yet that there's a constituency there that would seriously want to do that, especially in an election year. That's really going to be tough.
Yeah.
Just like the BRAC discussions that the department is trying to generate right now, I think it's going to be very difficult for the folks up there to swallow anything like that in an election year.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Well, Jonathan, we do right now. We've reached the end of our first segment, so we have to take a break right now. But when we return, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates about goings-on the Hill. And when we come back, I'm going to ask him a little bit about how a lame duck session really works, since he's lived through some of them. I think that might be interesting. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Han Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Han's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Han Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Han's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Han lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Han Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
Peter Bosch, Medical Director, Ambulatory EHR and Health IT Policy, MedStar Health, commented during the panel discussion titled Electronic Health Records 2.0, What Does the Future Hold? Brought to you by Booz Allen Hamilton.
The biggest game changer is get the healthcare system and payment right. Get those aligned, and if we get those aligned, the health IT will follow.
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen. That's federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen. Electronic health records can offer benefits for patients, providers, and payers, but have not yet realized their full potential. Booz Allen Hamilton believes the next 5 to 10 years will see vast changes in the EHR environment. As mobile health applications proliferate, information is more readily shared, and EHRs take on a key role in delivering high-quality, patient-centered health care. Count on Booz Allen to help you be ready for what's next. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
When agencies are trying to squeeze all the pennies they can, should they still be paying for contractors' retirement benefits? A taxpayer advocacy group says resoundingly no, at least not if contractors insist on offering pension plans. In a new report, Citizens Against Government Waste says the practice, which has been standard for years, is growing too costly. As pension costs rise, agencies could be in for a tenfold increase in payments for their contractors' retirement benefits.
These are hard times for federal employees. A multi-year pay freeze, rumors of furloughs, and discussions on reducing benefits are the realities that all federal employees face. Now, more than ever, it's important to find ways to save your hard-earned money. One way is with life insurance from WEPA. WEPA offers lower rates and a premium refund policy that's returned over $58 million to its policyholders since 1996. To learn how much you can save, visit WAEPA.org. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
Please join Jim Fleisig on Tuesday, March 6th at 12 noon for his monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum. This month will be a CIO roundtable discussing secure information and intelligence sharing, live from the 2012 AFSEA Homeland Security Conference. Jim's guests will be from DOD, DOJ, and DNI. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum, Tuesday, March 6th at 12 noon on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Sponsored by the AFSEA Homeland Security Conference.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible.
March for Babies!
Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7742.
Attention federal managers. The Federal Managers Association invites all federal managers, supervisors, and executives to its National Management Training Seminar, Federal Managers Doing More with Less, on Tuesday, March 13th. Federal managers will gather in Arlington, Virginia for practical presentations, including 7 quick fixes for enhancing performance, improving employee productivity and well-being, and decisively addressing conduct-related issues. For more details, visit fedmanagers.org. That's fedmanagers.org.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we're talking about Capitol Hill and what's going on up there and doing a little political science 101 with one of my favorite people who I got to know on the Sarah panel. And John, you know, when we left, I set up this segment by saying that, you know, maybe we can talk a little bit about, you know, how a lame duck session works. And, you know, my thought is, do people who are leaving, you know, potentially decide to do, quote, the right thing, whatever that may be from their perspective. How does that work in terms of trying to get business done? You lived through a few of those when you were up on the Hill.
Sure. Well, it really will depend, obviously, on the number of incumbents that return. And what's left to be done? I think that given the way I expect this year to play out, there will be a lot on the plate for people to deal with when they get back. We already talked about the budget process for FY13. We've talked about efforts to stave off sequestration. Those will be two major things. There may be as well other legislative priorities or legislation that will be driven by events that haven't even occurred yet. So that may be so you'll see a much bigger plate of things, I think, this year as we get off the election and into a lame duck than maybe in a normal lame duck year where most of the focus is around finishing the budget process. But I also think that it'll be interesting to see a number of the political pundits have looked at the poll numbers and have detected a very obvious dissatisfaction with incumbents in Congress this year. And if we have a lot of changes as a result of that, if it's, you know, some sort of a wave type election, you're going to have a lot of people who are no longer going to be serving in the next Congress who will suddenly be in a position to vote, and that will obviously greatly compound the problems that the majority leader, minority leaders will have in both houses to try to manage that process. It's very difficult, and a lot of it has to do with timing. I think when folks come back, and let's say they, you know, around the time, maybe a week or two before the Thanksgiving break, and start up again, I don't generally expect a lot to happen then. The real action occurs when folks come back from Thanksgiving, and then there are threats to keep people, you know, there for longer, and then it's just a matter of, you know, pushing through. But one of the factors that does enter into it is if you get people who were not reelected, who ran for reelection and were not reelected, defeated in their campaigns, then you have to really ask yourself, what is the incentive for folks like that to stick around? At some point, people will start voting with their feet. So you do have this relatively narrow period in December when you really have to do as much as you can do before issues and votes and things really become an issue, you know, for both sides. So it'll be a very tricky process this year, especially given some of the fairly momentous issues that people are going to be faced with. We'll have tax rate renewals issues. We're going to have the budget. We're going to have sequestration. I mean, there will just be a lot of things on the plate.
And how does, I guess, you know, just from your observation, how does sort of, to the extent there is party discipline, or just, you know, when people are, you know, like you said, getting ready to leave, how does that all play out? Is it just depending on the person, or does, I mean, psychologically, it seems to me people may decide, well, you know what, you know, I never really agreed with this particular position, so I'm going to go this way. Or they may, out of sense of loyalty, you know, stay with, you know, their leadership. I don't know.
I think the other factor is habit. I think if people are in the habit of voting with the leadership through the tenure in office, I think generally those habits will then carry forward.
Yeah.
You don't see too many of the people that, at least in my experience, who, you know, just suddenly do a 180 on their positions because they're no longer going to. There may be certain issues that they feel that way about, but in general, that's not what really happens. And I think the thing you want to watch for is how much progress the Congress makes on some of these big issues in December. And then if it becomes evident that they're simply not going to be able to finish up a lot of the things, then we get into some sort of a triage mode in terms of people saying, well, this can wait until the new Congress returns in January, and this can wait, and this can wait, and they really start to focus on some of the things that they believe can't wait. That may be one of the outcomes that we'll see when folks get back.
Ed, one other question just about sort of the big picture, and that is government reorganization. And, you know, back, we were talking about it off air a little bit. You know, the president introduced or put out the idea of reorganizing some of the trade offices within government, and, you know, and then the idea of the SBA being elevated to department level, then I guess eventually made part of the Department of Commerce. Is there appetite, do you think, on the Hill right now, or are there too many other issues going for sort of reorganization as folks try to figure out how to deal with the deficit going forward, and, you know, have sequestration and whatever other cuts or tax increases that, you know, people are going to be talking about, at least, you know, with debating. Is there any debate or discussion about how to reorganize government, or should government be reorganized?
I think there'll be a lot of discussion, especially in certain corners where constituencies that would like to see their agency or their interests in the executive branch elevated, if they see that as part of this reorganization, there'll be some discussion about that. But I frankly don't think there'll be any stomach to do anything major. If you look at the way the government is organized now, and you see what appear to be duplicative agencies, and, you know, in all these various areas, you really have to ask yourself, well, why is that? You know, that certainly isn't because of some plan that somebody had, where they said, well, let's create all these agencies that essentially duplicate one another. It's because over the years, constituencies have grown up around various pieces of this, whether it's trade or other areas, and a lot of those constituencies are in Congress. And the committee jurisdictions are built around those as well. So I'm very skeptical that anybody is going to seriously want to tackle this, given all the other things that they have out there that they want to try to deal with. It would really be incumbent on the president and others to really convince people that there's a sense of urgency here, or that there's a sense that somehow things have to be tied up together with deficit reduction or some other major national goal. And I haven't really seen those arguments advanced. I mean, it's sort of like, well, if we get rid of this agency and collapse it into something, we can save X dollars on salaries. That's really not the same kind of argument that you make based on some of these bigger issues.
That's sort of like a technical, you know, operational level discussion as opposed to a visionary discussion.
Right.
Yeah.
And my one personal experience with reorganization was working the Goldwater-Nichols Act back in the mid-'80s, and that was a process that stretched, frankly, over many years. And there was a sense, based on some experience that we'd had in military operations in the early 80s, that there was a sense of urgency to, you know, the reorganization that people wanted. And even with that, it took a long time, and there was a lot of battling behind the scenes between various constituencies on the Hill until the language was finally agreed to in 1985, rather. So that there is a lot of that I think would have to work itself out, and I just don't see that this year gives an arena for that to happen.
Right. Well, it seems to that point that, you know, when you're not really just talking about reorganizing the executive branch, right? It would in turn impact how, you know, Congress is structured.
Correct.
At a working level, right?
Right.
Interesting stuff. You know, Jonathan, we're just coming up on the break, so we'll have to take a break right now, but When we come back, we'll be talking more with Jonathan Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we're going to turn our attention to the subject that's really near and dear to our hearts here on Off the Shelf, and that's procurement policy and what's going on the Hill and with the Defense Authorization Act right now. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Government year-end is fast approaching. Look to GSA Advantage and the Han Company now and anytime you're challenged with a compressed time frame or to do more but spend less. Now more than 400 of Han's newest and top models are available online and at great manufacturer direct prices. You'll find multi-purpose chairs, smart desk solutions, durable storage cabinets, contemporary conference tables, and more to fit any office need. All meet or exceed government sustainability requirements, too. To shop Han Direct, go to gsaadvantage.gov and type Han's contract number 27F, like furniture, 0015S, like Sam, in the search bar. That's 27F0015S. When you need office furniture, GSA Advantage is a quick, safe way to buy online, and Han lets you stretch your budget without compromising quality or style. Buy Han Direct. Go to gsaadvantage.gov and search contract 27F0015S today.
Arming your home security system gives you peace of mind, but are you paying $30, $40, $50 or more in monitoring fees? Switch to Ackerman Security Systems, the metro area's most trusted name in security, and pay just $18.95 a month. That's right, $18.95 a month, and no cost to switch. Don't have a system? Then Ackerman offers the latest technology, including wireless monitoring. Call by Wednesday and get 3 months of basic monitoring free when you switch or start service with Ackerman. Call 888-999-1070, AckermanSecurity.com.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
AU fans, be a part of the excitement as March Madness returns to Bender Arena. Postseason tickets are on sale now for the 2012 Patriot League Men's Basketball Tournament beginning February 29th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets start at $6 for youth and $12 for adults for individual games for great chairback seat locations. Don't miss the action as the Eagles make their run back to the NCAA Tournament. It all starts February 29th with the quarterfinal round from Bender Arena. To secure your tickets, visit AUEagles.com or call 202-885-TIXX today.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
At Kaiser Permanente, we carefully select our doctors so you can carefully select your doctors. Our hiring process is so selective, only 1 in 10 doctors who apply make the cut. Yes, we're uber picky. Probably have a little perfectionism complex in there, but by putting our doctors under the microscope, we've discovered some of the greatest medical minds in their fields, and that's led to an even greater medical breakthrough. Drumroll, please. Award-winning care. We've received many of the highest possible rankings in member satisfaction, patient safety, overall quality of care, and more. But we're not the only ones reaping the rewards. Because we carefully select our doctors, you have great doctors to choose from. And with all those great doctors, you think it'd be easy. But try choosing just one for your primary care doctor. We'll let you create your own highly selective process for that. We're Kaiser Permanente, and we're here to help you thrive. Visit us at kp.org.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
On Wednesday, an extra leap day is added to our calendar. Most of us won't give it much thought, but calendar precision has been important to human civilization. and may become a hot topic again. Earth's daily rotation isn't linked to its orbit around the sun, which takes a bit longer than 365 days. So Jason Casabri, a University of Alabama engineer, says here in the northern hemisphere,
if you didn't account for that extra quarter day plus change, then eventually January 1st would actually be in the summertime.
We've pretty well fixed things by adding leap days here on Earth, but Casabri's working on getting to other planets and says such calendar adjustments
might become more important again, because then you have to start worrying about, well, if people are living on Mars, what calendar are they going to go by?
As he works on deep space travel issues, though, Casabri says,
having that extra day just gives me an extra day to get work done.
Find out more at www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we've been talking about mechanics of Capitol Hill and just the budget process and a host of different issues facing Congress this year and into next year. But now we're going to turn, as I mentioned at the break, we're going to turn to a little bit more focused on procurement policy questions and issues. And first, I guess this is sort of a budget issue, but also a procurement challenge, I sort of speak. And it's a Section 808 authorization bill that, as I understand it, Jonathan, would limit aggregate spending on services by the department to FY10 levels. Is that correct?
Right. That's correct. Yeah.
So how is that going to play out and what's going on with that?
Well, there are a number of different components to this, and I think it's one of the things people need to realize is this: there's a little bit of a background here, and I think partly the concern that drove this was the fact that there have been freezes on federal employee salaries and on size of the federal workforce the last couple of years in response to some of the deficit concerns. And so this language sort of came as a counterpart to that, also driven by the concern in the amount of services that have been contracted with on the private sector, especially since 9/11, and especially in the Department of Defense. So this language essentially says that the overall spending for services in the aggregate in FY12 and FY13 are supposed to be held at the level of FY10. I'm not exactly sure if DOD has the ability to track spending in that way, especially in a contemporaneous manner, to actually understand how that is being done. It's probably going to be something that would have to be determined after the fact. But beneath that requirement, there are a number of other requirements that we will shortly, I believe, see guidance from DOD to execute. One of them has to do with the fact that they want more responsible high-level approval for every service contract above $10 million, so we'll see what that looks like. And this one, I think, will be somewhat controversial. They want, as a negotiation objective on all contracts above $10 million, that labor rates are held at the FY10 levels, which it means we'd have to ignore inflation, you'd have to ignore issues such as the skill mix that you might need or how that may have evolved and things like that. I think that will be somewhat controversial. There's a requirement that they eliminate any contract for the performance of inherently governmental functions, which I think on its face is fairly non-controversial. I think everybody agrees across the board that contractors should not be performing inherently governmental function. But there also is a requirement that there be a reduction by 10% every year. This would be 10% in 2012 and 10% in 2013. Spending on staff augmentation contracts and contracts for the performance of the little understood area, which is performance of functions closely associated with inherently governmental functions. The Defense Department guidance on that under the law is supposed to be out before the end of the month. So we hopefully, or not, we will see this in the next few days or shortly thereafter as to how this will all get implemented. I think there'll be some real management challenges with the department. I think it'll be interesting to see how people are tracking the FY10 spending in light of some of the cuts that have already been put in the budget for FY12 and FY13, and how that will be accounted for. But this I think, could present some real challenges for both the department and for industry as folks try to implement this. And as I said, I think it's really being driven by the politics around some of the impacts on the federal workforce that have occurred as a result of some of the deficit reduction efforts over the last year.
Yeah, but what this does, right, it seems to me, it frames the market,
right,
for services, how big it's going to be, what levels you can essentially charge from a competitive, a ceiling, sort of lowers the ceiling to, as you indicated, to labor rates based on FY10.
Right.
You know, the
well, that's a negotiation objective. It's not a mandate, a legislative mandate. But how that gets implemented and how that gets balanced out with some of the other issues that you want and some of the other changes that are actually ongoing right now in the Department of Defense, I think it'll be a challenge for the department and I think to some extent for industry to cope with.
Yeah, another area that I know it's hot right now that you're focused on a fair amount is rights and technical data.
Right.
And yeah, tell us what's going on there with the department.
Well, we had more or less reached an equilibrium, at least legislatively, on the issue of rights and technical data and how those rights would be allocated starting about 1995 in terms of the final guidance that came out in the regulations, and there was a lot of congressional involvement. It was about an 11-year process to get there. And finally, we sort of reached an equilibrium. I don't think either the industry side or the government side, or you know, even within industry, everybody was totally happy with the outcome. But I think people just got tired and said, "Let's just go forward with this." And things were pretty quiet for quite a while. And then a couple of years ago, the Senate folks decided that they wanted to revisit some of the issues based on some of the things that they were hearing from some of the offices in the field. And so there was this idea of coming up with clarifications or new rules that basically would do a better job of ensuring competition or the option of competition throughout the life of a program. And the second issue, ensuring that the government doesn't end up paying for the same data twice that it may have developed. And so this has gone through a number of different iterations, and some of them actually, if you lay them side by side, that one looks starkly different than the one that went before. But I think where we are now is they've settled on some language, and I think working with the Department of Defense, which essentially tries to capture a couple of new ideas. One is that rather than have time limits on when contractors are required to provide technical data, the new language basically says at any time, it doesn't even limit it to the period of performance under the contract, that the Department of Defense can go back and ask for the data to be provided for any case that was either funded solely at government expense or in a mixed funding situation. And they also have language in there that basically says that if there's this so-called idea of interface data, which would allow you to segregate or reintegrate elements of a system, that just data sufficient to do that, whether it's commercial data or not, essentially, the contractors would be required, notwithstanding any other contract provision, to provide that data. Now, that requirement does not relate to a license for the use. That's handled in another part of the statute. But I think, depending on how DOD implements this, it's going to cause some very interesting concerns because it does have sort of this unlimited aspect, and it also applies now to items or processes that were utilized, not merely generated in the performance of a contract, but just happened to be utilized in the performance of a contract.
And, so you utilize something that you developed exclusively at private expense,
right.
They'll be able to get
Something around that, whether it's the interface data or something that would allow, you know, and again, defining what that means, how deep do you go in order to get the data, you know, how does it apply to software? I mean, there are a number of questions. And we're now in an environment where the department is putting great premium on competition. The Congress is also doing the same thing. If you read the Weapons Systems Acquisition Reform Act and its mandates and some of the other mandates, it's basically to preserve the option of competition throughout a system and throughout the life cycle of the system. It's not clear how this will actually be implemented once it goes out into the field. So there's a lot of concern about it.
Jonathan, what's clear right now is we have to take our last break. But when we return, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton Associates about procurement developments and procurement policies or legal developments on the Hill. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explain how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Hey, Caps fans! On the move but need your Caps info? Then download the official Caps mobile app to your Android, iPhone, or BlackBerry. With the Caps mobile app, you can follow the game with real-time scores and stats and access news, photos, podcasts, videos, and Twitter feeds anytime, anywhere. To download, text Caps app to 43803 or log on to WashingtonCaps.com. Stay Caps connected with Caps Mobile.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit myvillagegreen.com. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Garden of Life and Boron.
In the beloved fairy tale Beauty and the Beast, Belle and the Beast learn that true beauty is found within and live happily ever after. Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly one in three children in America are overweight or obese. Now is the time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. To learn more, visit letsmove.gov. Brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Ad Council.
Meeting mission goals through health, brought to you by General Dynamics IT.
The Justice Department and the Department of Health and Human Services are reporting record-breaking health care fraud recoveries for 2011. The program returned $4.1 billion to the Medicare Trust Fund and the Treasury last year. That includes $2.4 billion in bogus claims they recovered in civil court and $1.3 billion in fines and restitution in criminal cases. Officials credit a new anti-fraud team the two departments created in 2009.
General Dynamics IT is meeting the challenges of a complex healthcare environment that requires far-reaching experience and full-spectrum capabilities. Government, military, and commercial health payer organizations rely on General Dynamics IT's health services, solutions, and support to tackle their toughest issues. General Dynamics IT's broad understanding of healthcare data, military health missions, fraud, waste, and abuse protection, and more ensures support and innovation tailored to your real-world needs. Today's healthcare challenges are formidable. To learn more, go to GDIT.com.
I love my husband. But I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON.
Listen each week for Tech Tuesday on Federal News Radio. Every Tuesday, we zero in on how technology inspires innovation. Tuesday mornings at 11, it's Federal Tech Talk with John Gilroy, the latest on products that help bring policy to life. Then Tuesday afternoons at 12:30, join Federal News Radio's Jason Miller for Ask the CIO. Hear from the top of the food chain on how your agency is using technology today. Tech Tuesday, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to John Etherton, and we're talking about current developments in terms of statutory, regulatory policy developments, the Hill, all those kind of things, the budget process. And when we had to take our last break, we were talking a little bit about rights and technical data and a change in sort of philosophy, policy approach in terms of access to data in the interest of fostering competition. That's a laudable goal, and we all believe in the idea of competition, but what are some other considerations that go with that folks need to focus on? I think of incentives for innovation in developing, you know, systems and in intellectual property and that sort of thing.
Right.
How it plays against the current policy.
That's basically the other side of this. And I think that that's why I believe that clarity around the implementation is going to be critical for this. Because if people are forced into a mode because of lack of clarity on the industry side, if they're forced into a defense stance on protecting intellectual property, especially as it relates to anything around a commercial product, then what you effectively do is really cut DOD off from certain innovative solutions that you know make, in fact, for more competition in terms of different approaches on how to solve problems or support missions. So that's really the challenge. And we had an open forum last week at the George Washington University Law School on the subject.
Well, was that with my friend Steve Schooner?
Yes, he was there, and we had several people. It was a great discussion. And I made a plea for having a proposed rulemaking process for this issue, because I really think it's worth spending a little extra time to get it right, given also the new concepts that are out there and some of the long-term harm that could come from inadequate implementation. And there may be some issues that we still need to look at as far as legislative clarification. So we'll see how all this plays out. But it is the age-old problem of balancing competition with incentives for innovation. And some people probably would think, given this language, that we're probably tilting a little more on the competition side. And the question is, can we, with sufficient clarity, provide a regime that does a better balance? And I guess that remains to be seen.
Right. Well, I mean, I think your thought about, you know, a rulemaking process or a deliberative process to make sure you get it right, I think, you know, when I hear you say that, what I think is the stakes couldn't be higher, right?
Right.
I mean, when you fundamentally think about you know, our armed forces and our defense capabilities, the thing that sets us apart, frankly, from everybody else is, you know, the sophistication, the, you know, state-of-the-art, the technology that we have that we're able to deliver, whether it's UAVs, you know, stealth technology, all those sort of things, right? And being able to continue to develop then take advantage of what we develop commercially here, too,
right,
as well, as part of all that, that's what maintains our edge. And, you know, and so I appreciate the idea of having a deliberative process to make sure you get that balance right.
Yeah, you really don't want people holding back applications of commercial technology, nor do you want companies dissuaded from making internal investments in R&D through independent research and development. Those are things that really have strong payoffs and really give the Department of Defense, for example, technological solutions that are most affordable. So that's really the thing that you want to try to protect.
Right. And so let's turn to another subject where, speaking of protection, you know, there's some, you talk a little bit about counterfeit electronic parts,
right,
and where we are with that.
Well, this was an issue. The Senate Armed Services Committee investigation staff did a year-long investigation and uncovered some very disturbing things about the way that counterfeit electronic parts had worked their way into application on weapons programs through, you know, the lack of controls on independent distributors and things like that. So as a result of that, they had a hearing relatively late last year, and some of the folks came in, and there was a good discussion. It was a very long hearing, and different options were looked at. And as a result of that, when the defense authorization bill was on the Senate floor, as it was very late in November, language was included in the bill that would essentially provide for a new regime, a very emphatic regime, to try to prevent counterfeit electronic parts from working their way into the system and being applied on weapons programs where we could have lives endangered and other kinds of problems occur, or degradation of operational capability. So that language is in the bill. Frankly, we were, from the industry side, folks were kind of concerned because it came in pretty late. There wasn't a lot of opportunity to comment on it, and one of the major issues that I don't think the language is adequately addressed is the issue of liability for companies that fully comply with the requirements in the language. Because one of the things that the language essentially does is it says that if you comply with the requirements to use OEMs or authorized distributors or certified independent distributors for sourcing electronic parts, and even having done all that and through one of those sources, somehow a counterfeit part works its way into the system and there's a need to remove it or do some other kind of remediation, all of that cost is an unallowable cost now, irrespective of whether you've fully followed the rules or not. And that's quite a bit of a different approach than, for example, the Missile Defense Agency testified that they were using prior to this law, which was essentially to say they had a process. It was a fairly labor-intensive process, especially for DCMA, which was charged with certifying the independent distributors. But basically what their process, how it worked, and this was what General O'Reilly testified on the record, is that if the companies followed that policy to the letter and they still had a problem with an electronic part that was counterfeit, in that case, the cost of replacement was allowable. And so there was a limitation on the liability, essentially, for a contractor following the rules and having a fully compliant system. That's kind of that's sort of like a safe harbor
right. kind of situation.
And we have issues now where you have liabilities where the, where they're really there's not much of a vestige of a safe harbor anymore in this language, and I think a lot of folks are quite concerned about it.
It's almost like you're always at fault, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and talk real quickly. You know, I know fixed price major weapon systems and low rate initial production, LRIP.
Right.
What's going on there?
Well, we have a number of issues that I think we're likely to see come up this year, either in the markups of the bills or when the bills go to the floor as floor amendments. A couple of examples. Last year, Senator McCain and Hyote from New Hampshire basically had a provision which would have mandated much greater use of fixed-price contracting and low-rate initial production on major programs. They had worked some language which I think was fairly balanced language. Unfortunately, because of the floor procedures, once cloture was invoked, there's a very strict germaneness test on any amendments that can be adopted after cloture is adopted. And in this case, the amendment did not amend any language. There was no related language already in
right,
the bill.
Right, so it was just throwing something completely new. Right?
So they threw it out. I mean, just on that basis. And I'm absolutely convinced and assured that that language will be back, and we'll probably see it taken up in the markup when the Senate Armed Services Committee marks up their bill. Another provision or another area that I think will also get some attention is concurrency. December 15th, Senator McCain gave a very...
Explain for the listeners what a concurrency is.
Concurrency is basically a situation where you are doing development at the same time in a program where you start production.
Yeah.
In a sense, you have an overlap there. It basically,
so sort of what happened with the presidential helicopter?
Right, yeah. and you know, with the F-35 and a couple of the other programs, mm-hmm. it sort of comes and goes as a concept. People make different arguments in favor or against it over time. But Senator McCain gave a very interesting speech on the military-industrial complex in the record on December 15th. It's actually on his website if folks want to go read it. Frank Kendall, who is the deputy undersecretary and now the nominee to be the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics, gave a talk over at the Center for Strategic and International Studies a week or so ago, and he made several very favorable references to that speech. I think that there will be some action as a result of some of the concerns that were raised by Senator McCain. I think we're likely to see that taken up in the authorization bill as well.
So to limit concurrency?
In some fashion, to have some sort of a process to oversee that and bring it under a better control.
Right, or say, you have to do it anyway, I'm sure. Explain why you need to do it.
Right.
And have several levels of review of that.
Or something, yeah. I don't know exactly what form it'll take, but I think that was a clear signal that we're likely to see that issue addressed in some fashion in the bill when it's marked up in the spring.
Hey, well, Jonathan, thank you very much for being on the show. I appreciate you being here, and it's been a fun discussion and always an interesting discussion. So I want to thank John Etherton for joining me today. I'm Roger Waldron, and this is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition of Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.